Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Nothing to Fear, a weekly horror movie podcast. My name is Billy Schultz, and I'm the host of the show, and this week I am not joined by my two co-hosts, Alex and Luke, although you will hear them for our discussion about the movie this week. We are all living human lives, and everyone is real busy, and we just didn't have the time to record an intro properly for this week, so you're stuck with me until about the five-minute mark, and at which point, feel free to jump to the time codes ahead if you want to hear us get into the movie of the week. So, yeah, not much in the way of movie news. I guess for new listeners, if this is your first episode, what we do every single week, we watch a different horror movie and talk all about it. And this month, for the month of May, we are smack dab in the middle of the five top most common phobias, which is very exciting. And this movie that we're talking about is called Copycat, and it sort of centers a character that has agoraphobia, number four most common phobia. So yeah, we'll not dilly-dally too much in the intro because I don't have Luke or Alex to sort of bounce ideas off or do horror movie news, but there is one piece of general entertainment news that's going around in the world these days, and that is the writer's strike. Of course, the Writers Guild of America, if you don't know, they went on strike because basically corporate studios are not paying them and making record profits and not paying the writers. So I know that we have a long history of making fun of horror movie writing on this show and kind of poo-pooing muddy lines and things like that, but that should not be an indictment of the profession at all, and I firmly believe, and I speak for everyone at the show, that writers deserve to get paid. So if anybody who is a writer or is on the picket line right now, yeah, we at Nothing to Fear are with you and support writers, all of that stuff, because every creative people deserve to get paid. Everyone deserves to get paid for what they do. So yeah, that's really it. The real horror is capitalism. Who knew it? Anyway, we're going to jump on into our discussion of 1995's Copycat. Please enjoy the episode, and I'll turn it over to Billy, Alex, and Luke. Alex Wan, you pick the movie for this week. Tell us the phobia and the title of the movie.
So the title of the movie is Copycat, and the phobia is agoraphobia. Yeah. I believe that was number four on the top five list.
Number four, which is, it's defined as like a fear of either being out around people in situations where you can't control everything, or just like being out of like a safe environment in general. What did you know about Copycat before you picked this one? Was it just like a Google?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was just a Google. I didn't know anything about this movie. So I think I might have mentioned this a previous week, either on or off recording, but it was hard to pick a movie. That's why, because like when you picked Cujo, that was actually supposed to be my week. And I was like, I don't know what the fuck to pick. So yeah, it did take a while for me to choose something that not only fit the criteria, but was something I wanted to watch. Because
fair. Yeah.
I was kind of over picking a movie just for the sake of picking it. So yeah, I was like Googling stuff for like probably 40 minutes before I picked Copycat.
Okay.
So yeah, so can't say I don't do my homework, right?
That's true.
You do a good job. Yeah, pick Copycat, and yeah, it's agoraphobia.
We'll talk about it after the trailer. Luke, did you know anything about Copycat before viewing this one, or had any inklings?
I feel like it was in the recesses of my memory somewhere, but I'd never seen it, and so, no, not really.
See, when you said Copycat, I was like, oh, okay. I think I remember a movie where a woman like makes friends with a roommate, and then she sort of like copies her and steals her identity and is like very stalkerish. Mm. And so I was like, oh, I bet you that's that movie. And I think Glenn Close is in it. Glenn Close is not in this movie.
Is that the one with Minka Kelly and what's her name from Gossip Girl?
Maybe they did a remake, but there's one that I was thinking of, which was Single White Female, which the original one was Bridget Fonda and Jennifer Jason Leigh. I don't know if it got remade. It probably it has. So I thought it was going to be Single White Female, which I thought had Glenn Close in it. Does not have Glenn Close in it. Glenn Close was in a movie called Fatal Attraction with Michael Douglas, where he is a married man who sleeps with her, and then she like becomes obsessed with him. And so I guess all that to say is I was way off when this movie started, because I was like, all right, when is the stalking going to happen between these two female leads, Sigourney Weaver and Holly Hunter? Oh, it isn't. When is the like identity theft going to happen? Oh, not this one either. Okay, so I don't know what's going on in this movie. But what was this Minka Kelly one?
The Roommate. It was with Leighton Meester.
Okay.
Yeah, it's just about a roommate in college. I don't know. I didn't watch it. The tagline was 2,000 colleges, 8 million roommates. Which one will you get?
Oh. Oh, okay.
So but not relevant it? To this.
No,
to,
not relevant. To this movie. No, so I guess all that to say is I went in completely blind and had a little bit of a shudder at the 2-hour runtime. And I can't, you know, sort of wait to talk about it. But before we do, I guess for DoesTheDogDie.com, there's not a lot in the way of horror for this movie. This one's definitely firmly in the camp of a thriller dramatic movie. In terms of like the gore is very slight, there's some blood, but it's very red. The triggers would be like stalking, gaslighting, kind of depiction of like mental illness. And this is one that is very cop focused. So I know that sometimes police can be a trigger for people. And so this one is really like.
Oh, Billy jumping in here. One other trigger that I forgot to mention in my list was that this movie has quite a few scenes that involve sexual assault. So go in so armed with that. Back to your regularly scheduled. Bullshitting.
I think you're missing the most important one.
A lot of cops.
Or not the most important one.
Oh, serial killers.
No, agoraphobia.
Also agoraphobia. Right. Yep. You're right.
fourth worst one, Billy.
Yeah, fair. Anyway, check out the website for doesthedogdie.com. But oh, you know what? Early spoiler. I'm gonna go ahead and say we can classify this as a horror movie because as established in our canon that if a house burns down or explodes in the movie, then that's something that happens in horror movies, and that happens in this one. So it's a horror movie to me.
Okay.
Let's get into it. We'll go to the trailer and then we'll talk all about Copycat when we get back.
What turns on a killer is the suffering and death of another human being. And as his determination builds to take another life, he plans in obsessive detail what props he'll bring, what knots he'll tie. Let me ask you guys something. What turns you on?
A criminal psychiatrist.
There's a serial killer out there who strangled 3 women. He's gonna do it again.
A homicide detective.
Would you work with us on this?
You're kidding, right?
I do not want you discussing this case with her in any shape, way, or form.
It's the Boston Strangler.
Are you telling me this guy's copycatting a serial killer's been dead for
20 years?
You're looking for an intelligent white male, 20 to 30 years old, socially functional.
Everything's different. Different guy.
He's switched from DeSalvo to Bianchi and Buono, the Hillside Strangler.
One man is copying the most notorious killers in history. One at a time.
He's sending you letters like he's daring us to nail him.
If he wants to be famous, he has to be caught.
I'm death and life to you, Doc.
We know that Mr. Cullen was safe in San Quentin last night, so how come his book shows up under the mattress?
Together, 2 women must stop him.
The man who has killed 5 women in this city was just in your apartment.
Before he kills again.
All I know to do is change your locks, tighten up your security, and pray.
Sigourney Weaver, Holly Hunter, and Harry Connick Jr. in a deadly game of cat.
Here, kitty, kitty, kitty.
And mouse. Copycat.
Copycat is a 1995 American psychological thriller film / possibly horror, directed by John Amiel and starring Sigourney Weaver, Holly Hunter, and Dermot Mulroney. An agoraphobic psychologist and a female detective must work together to take down a serial killer who copies serial killers from the past.
So this movie was made for $20 million and cleared $79 million at the box office when it came out in 95. Rotten Tomatoes puts it at a 75% certified fresh, and IMDb 6.6. So it's always 6 point something on IMDb. Alex Wan, let us hear your first thoughts about Copycat.
Yeah, I don't know if this is a horror movie. I'm gonna lean on no, but
I think the house burns down, so it's a horror movie.
I mean, there's always a fine line between psychological thriller and horror. Mm-hmm. So you know, I guess you could classify it as a light horror. You know, like light reading. It's light horror.
Sure.
I too, when I picked this movie, I was like. I looked at the runtime, 2 hours. I was like, yeah, Alex, you dumbass. What'd you do this to yourself? And then I realized 2 hours of Holly Hunter with bangs is probably the greatest thing that I've seen in months. So yeah, I wasn't complaining as the movie started.
All right, fair.
Yeah, I was quite happy with that. Yeah, I think overall it was a fine movie. There wasn't anything exceptional about it. I did think the acting was good. So, like, the two leads, Sigourney mm-hmm. Weaver and Holly Hunter, were definitely carried this movie. The plot was okay. The villain was okay. The agoraphobia was very minuscule, actually. I didn't think it was important to the plot, but it didn't play a huge role. Do you know what I mean?
I have a definite thought to share about that when we get into it. But the agoraphobia
There was agoraphobia in it. It was very specifically agoraphobia, so I think that criteria was met. But yeah, overall, it was a fine movie. I have nothing exceptional to say about it other than the two leads. And I don't have really any major complaints about it outside of some few plot points and, you know, Schrodinger's Chinatown case.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, it was fine, and it's exactly what I would imagine a 90s psychological thriller to be like.
Absolutely. Yeah, this I looked it up because Silence of the Lambs came out in 1991, and so this feels like Silence of the Lambs made all the money in the world. It had a go-get-em FBI agent with a southern accent solving crimes and not taking any shit from the, like, men in her life, and so they said, well, Jodie Foster did that, so let's have Holly Hunter also do that. But instead of interviewing Hannibal Lecter, she's interviewing Sigourney Weaver, who's a scared lady, who's agoraphobic. And so it felt very much like, oh yeah, this was a time when Silence of the Lambs made it big, and so a lot of copycats were made, you know, to capitalize on the trend of cop serial killer type movies.
Alias is the name of a show.
Alias is the name of the show. Yeah, I mean, of course, the cast list is great. We got Sigourney Weaver. We know her from Alien and from a million other things. Avatar, if you're nasty. And Dermot Mulroney was in, of course, he was Insidious's dad in Insidious 3. And he was in Six Cream. So I was like, oh, good to see him again. A very young version of him. It was good. And yeah, Holly Hunter, she's great. I loved her in this movie. I loved her in Incredibles. She does a good job. And more recently, she's in The Big Sick, which was a good movie that came out a few years ago. So yeah, this is a wonderful cast with a lot of, like, who's that guy that, you know, the actor that I played. And so
you're
that
thinking of
engaged.
Will Patton.
Yes, I looked him up. Will Patton. I was like, who's this fucking guy? Yeah, Will Patton, he's a journeyman actor. But yeah, this movie could have definitely lost some of the Chinatown stuff, the, like, middle sort of case. Spoiler alert, Dermot Mulroney dies in this movie. But I was like, oh, that doesn't really pay off. So it could have cut, I think, about 40 minutes out, and it would have been just fine. But yeah, we'll get into it. I want to hear Luke Mason, your thoughts, your initial volley at Copycat.
Well, of all the movies we've done, this is the most 90s movie. Like, every single frame of this film just, like, effusively bled 90s tropes and feel, you know, like, just every piece of technology was so paradigmatically 90s. Like, there, I can't even tell you how many clickety clack of keyboards was going on in this. You know, it's like just
so much clicky keyboard.
The beginning of solving problems by the internet. You know, it's just, it was delicious, actually. And it's like, it's so stupid. There's so many stupid tropes in this movie that are nostalgic to me. So I kind of glided over them. But there was a few moments where it's like, mm-hmm. oh my God, like, this movie is so stupid sometimes, especially in how unbelievable it is that this serial killer was as exacting and talented as he is, given how impassioned and off the cuff he is. Like, how there's just none of there's the logic went on vacation for this movie, you know.
That's, oh, absolutely.
And so once you park that out of your mind,
yeah,
you know, it's just not how they would have made a serial killer type of film, or more likely TV show today, you know. Like, there's something very mm-hmm. of the era. This movie is much less like a kind of thriller mystery as it is just a kind of a love letter to the 90s at this point in my because the plot itself
oh absolutely
is absurd.
Yeah.
Every villain just got a monologue back then, you know.
Everyone got a monologue, yeah.
Even if, like, they just, their actions don't fit their character.
Well,
by the end, right?
And even though I agree the acting of Sigourney Weaver and Holly Hunter was the best part, the acting of a lot of other characters in this was not very good. Like, it was just so over the top, especially the two serial killers that we get in this And some of the secondary characters are just like, whoa, can you believe it? It's like a cartoon. There were parts of this movie where I was like, this is a cartoon. Yeah. This isn't even a live action film.
One of my 90s notes was like, remember when sushi was like a crazy thing? Yeah. It's like,
whoa,
you know,
we're getting ethnic food.
Deliver sushi. What are you eating? You're going to eat that stuff? Don't you want to come and have a steak with me like an American? It's like, oh, all right.
This is the era where it was progressive to call it ethnic food.
Yeah, exactly. Jesus.
Holly Hunter is a national treasure. She's cute as a button. There's something about her accent that just drives me crazy. And I was reflecting on it a bit. Like, yeah, she's in lots of things, but I pretty much only remember her from the Coen Brothers movies, you know, Raising Arizona and Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? She's prominent in both of those. She's like the female lead in those ones. And she's amazing. But then I was like, she actually... probably her best dramatic role. She played the mom in that movie 13, Evan Rachel Wood's breakout movie of teenage girls. And that is a really intense movie. And then, yeah, I just remember she's in a lot of movies and she's great. And I don't know, even though the character dialogue of everyone, including Sigourney Weaver and Holly Hunter, is unbelievable, they did a great job. But I do have to say, and this is more about this podcast than this movie. I think I'm planting a flag with this film. I think there have been harbingers of this prior for a while now. But with this film, we have officially stopped being a horror movie podcast. And we have officially become a movie podcast that sometimes talks about horror movies. Because this is the least horror movie of any movie we've done. And I think it's not even close. There isn't a single moment of this movie where I was scared. And not even nervous. And there's, like, even though the content is horrific, being a serial killer, this movie is barely even a thriller, I thought, because of how sloppy the plot is and how cheesy the dialogue is. So I just want to plant that flag. Sure. No matter how many houses burn down at the end, we are officially no longer a horror movie podcast, and I want everybody to know that. And I do care.
He does. He does care. Absolutely cares who knows it. Well, there we go. So that opens it up to anything.
I enjoyed this movie. I wasn't bored. This movie didn't bore me and it didn't offend me. That's a pretty good standard to meet for at this stage in our runtime.
For sure. Okay, well, there you go. You heard it here first. It's we're officially just a movie podcast now. Mm-hmm. We can pick any movie, any genre. Yeah. Let's go.
Comedy month. Let's go. Let's talk about role models.
All right. Oh, yes, please. That'd be so good. Okay. All right. It's nice to see where you stand. We've got your line in the sand has been firmly drawn and no amount of waves will erase it.
It's a line in the cement.
Those are just the cracks between the different sidewalk panels.
That's right.
But just to return back to your point about the sort of the plot of this movie and the kind of the reason behind it, it was... like we both fell for this, Kelly and I, when we were watching it. The fact that they just sort of show you who the serial killer is right away, that it just feels like it has to be a red herring. We're like, well, it can't be this guy. It can't be him. This is too obvious.
Can't be the Elijah Woods type character of a decade prior.
Yeah. It can't be this like little handsome 90s boy. But no, it is. It's just him. They're like, oh, who's the killer? It's him. It's this guy. Now we just have to watch everybody else figure it out. And I don't know. I guess maybe people just didn't care as much in the 90s or they weren't expecting it. Yeah.
We are a 2023 audience of film. So as a 2023 audience of film, we say, oh, well, they're not going to show us the killer right away. And on top of that, they're going to have misdirection. They're going to have the Dermot Mulroney character actually be in cahoots with the killer. And that's what is something kind of cool about it. Or they're going to have this killer have actually attended the initial lecture. And we're going to find out he was in the building with her that day. Nope. None of that happens. It's just... here it is. Watch out.
It's a weird disciple.
Be careful.
Yeah.
You know?
That was like a trend, though, back then, right? Like, I'm thinking speed. We find out who the terrorist is right away.
That's true. Yeah.
Yeah, but
maybe they didn't have as many red herrings.
Yeah, but speed isn't a mystery movie, right? Like, there's nothing...
I mean, Sandra Bullock was a mystery to me when I saw it, so...
I mean, speed is an action film. This is not an action movie.
Yeah, that's fair. I mean, you're right, though. We're primed in 2023 to expect that
a more sophisticated movie.
You're laying false trails. Like, Kelly said, we paused at one point and Kelly was like, okay, here's my prediction. My prediction is this guy with the glasses is a red herring and it's really going to be her assistant, Andy, because Andy doesn't want her to get better. And so he like is doing job security by like stalking her. And I was like, oh, that's a really cool theory. I hope it's not true because it's the only queer character and I don't want them to be a bad guy. But that would be really interesting way to take it. No. They're just like, this guy who we see, he's the killer. Mm. And you know it, and they don't know it, but now you get to watch him figure it out.
Yeah, but then like, at the very end, you find out there was a puppet master. That was the big reveal, right?
A puppet master and the longest, second longest, like, freeze frame on a face. The title, of course, going to Pearl.
Who is the puppet master?
It was the
Daryl Lee Cullen guy.
Yeah, the initial. Yeah, like when he monologues at the end, he's writing a letter to another serial killer. He's like, please try and kill her. Yeah. Go forth, which my also, disciple. By the way, I got an authentic pair of panties.
Which also beggars belief that they're not screening the communications of a serial killer to people on the outside. Yeah. Because let's see. Thought one. Maybe he's talking to other people who might want to copycat him. What the fuck?
It's definitely
beggars belief. Every plot point of this movie beggars belief. And honestly, the reason that there isn't a deviation from that, the fact that every single one beggars belief actually makes it a better movie because it's internally consistent. Mm-hmm.
That's true.
It doesn't mishmash its own silliness, right? It embraces it.
That's fair. You're right. I'm being facetious about the house on fire making it a horror movie because this is not. It's not a horror movie. It's just simply it isn't. It's like Sigourney Weaver is scared. She's agoraphobic so she was this world-renowned psychologist, profiler, you know, serial killer profiler type person. And on a lecture tour, she got attacked by a serial killer who like killed one of the cops that was supposed to be providing her with security. She didn't die, and as a result she's like housebound with fear. And so I think this is maybe, Alex, what you're talking about, the agoraphobia sort of being there as like, okay, we said the word, but then none of the symptoms really
matched.
Well,
we said the word and it comes up a few times. It comes up the first time she tries to leave and then she can't because she's agoraphobic, and then that, I guess that's a pretty minor plot point, but one of the things is she just never leaves, right? So the cops always have to go to her and she's the expert.
Very Hannibal Lecter-y in a different way.
Yeah, and then at the very end she overcomes her agoraphobia by escaping.
Right.
And then that pays off, I guess.
I mean, I don't know if that's going to cure your agoraphobia because it's like you went outside, a guy tried to kill you, so you stayed in your house for a year, and then the next time you went outside, a different guy tried to kill you.
Right?
It's like, I think I'll probably stay inside forever now, for sure.
She might be a psychologist, but I think those stats are pretty easy.
Yeah.
So.
But like, also, I was looking up the symptoms of agoraphobia because I was curious. I was like, okay, well, how close did they play it to the medical diagnosis definition? And they took liberties, of course, because I take liberties with everything.
What? This
but like
film?
One of the things I know. Hold on to your hat. But like one of the things was like it's delusions. You have delusions of attack and delusions of things like happening to you. And her fears were completely valid. Like it was like, no, there is a person trying to kill me. If she was like truly agoraphobic, it's like you wouldn't actually be in danger. But your mind is like, nope, everything is danger. I could be everything. And they didn't even like let us think that it was maybe all in her head. It was just like, no, there's definitely someone who is definitely after her and nobody's going to believe her because she's got this diagnosis. So maybe that's what the thing is, like people just like dismissed her.
Do you think
you go, Luke.
Well, I was just do you think true agoraphobics see like hallways turn sideways when they're going through their swoons, or like is there are they like a fisheye lens?
Isn't it?
Yeah, it's like, yeah, will the camera work when we're supposed to be from Sigourney Weaver's POV when she's agoraphobing? I don't know the present continuous verb of that. It's just so like that's Sam Raimi took over for a little while for that. You know, like I got such Evil Dead vibes when it was the agoraphobic parts of it. And I was like, this is nauseating.
Sure. Maybe she lived in the Zelda Ocarina of Time Forest Temple.
Yeah.
You know, there was that twisty hallway.
Yep.
But like, I mean, I think that's cinematic license to like represent a mental disorder where it's like, yeah, maybe the hallway doesn't go shifty shafty, but like maybe you do get dizzy and you like one of the symptoms is dizziness and like hyperventilating. And so like it's just a way to, I think, convey dizziness, but yeah, mm-hmm. it's like, oh,
it was very disorienting when it was happening because it's so different from the rest of the cinematography of the film. It's like they got a brand new director to do those parts.
Just those parts. What were you going to say, Alex?
Yeah, I think like in like a better movie, like you as the audience would think she has it all in her head, right? And you wouldn't mm-hmm. reveal right away that there was someone in her apartment. But, you know, like the first time where she finds out, like, finds the dress she wore on the day on her bed, that would have been like, you wouldn't have seen any of the previous stuff coming up, and there wouldn't have been secret shots of someone maybe sneaking in.
Mm-hmm.
And then when he finally breaks in, you wouldn't see him breaking in and like disabling the telephone line. You know, you'd just probably have her hear things, but you wouldn't see for sure as an audience member, right?
Yeah, because we get immediately, she goes to have her shower scene, and we see, like, a shadow move across her window that she wouldn't see. So we're like, oh, there's a threat for sure. Also, on that dress, if I was almost murdered in a suit, I don't care how nice it is, I'm donating that suit. I'm throwing that suit in the garbage. I'm not keeping that suit, like, no chance.
Well,
no chance.
This is a good point, more movies broadly, and since we're a movie podcast, we can get to that now. It wasn't until, I'd say, maybe 15 years ago that movie studios started considering the fact that audiences weren't fucking idiots, and they could have a little bit of complication and misdirection.
As a treat.
Like, obviously, there are movies in 60s, 70s, 80s that are complicated and not spoon-feeding. Mm-hmm. But they're the exception. They're certainly not the norm. And I won't say they're the norm now, but studios are more willing to take risks on slightly more confusing plots because I think of a general acceptance that moviegoing audiences are a little bit smarter than they ever have been considered to be. And I mean, 90s movies are nothing compared to like movies from the 30s and 40s. When you watch that, it's like, are everybody watching these movies like full standard to two standard deviations lower IQ than people are now? Because this is ridiculous.
All they needed was those moving pictures. That was it. They didn't care.
So, and I think also the rise of television has helped that as well, right? Because you can actually make comprehensive, super long form visual narratives in a way that movies weren't really able to.
Yeah.
But hasn't, like, I feel like complicated stories have been around for a while. Is it like just because of the visual medium that they had to dumb it down? Because like there's been like radio shows, and I'm sure operas have had more complex, you know, plots and more intricate characters than that. So
yeah, or stage plays or something.
Opera specifically would have been historically more relegated to the upper classes, which are generally more educated in historical senses. And then radio, yeah, radio gets more popular culture, but I would also say a lot of radio is not that complicated, or certainly wasn't.
That's true.
Well, I'm thinking about those long kind of just radio stories, you know?
Yeah, it's also the medium, right? The medium, I think, changes and affects how you tell a story because you can do so much more in a movie than you can do on radio for communication of what's happening. And so you can, and the flip side of that, you can lose a lot more. You can leave people behind more easily if they're not paying attention because you have to be very, there's a lot more, I'm just thinking, like, we do a podcast, basically all of our communication is through our words and our tone, right? So we have to be quite conscious of what we're saying. We have to pick our words, if not carefully, then at least intentional. And
I don't do that.
Whereas there's so much storytelling you can do visually for people as well as audio.
That's true.
So you're saying that we should do a visual podcast now?
Oh, yeah.
Well, a video podcast.
Well, that would actually turn us back into a horror movie podcast. Or sorry, a horror podcast. Horrible for the watchers.
Hey. Fair enough.
Roasted.
Okay, yeah, like I don't really know what to branch off of that with, but yeah, the plot is a straight line when we all expected some twists and turns. Or some of those delightful San Francisco hills, maybe, even. But no, it was pretty much a straight shot. But I want to talk about the characterization of this serial killer whose, like, name, was he Peter? Like, his name was Peter. Your Discord name is Peter Rabid, Luke. And I was like, was his name Peter? Like, I don't even remember. It was just like the serial killer guy because it was like so unimportant to the movie.
No, because they find his address and they find his driver's license. His name's Peter Foley.
Oh, right. Okay. Peter Foley artist. One thing that struck me with this movie was like how it delved into the true crime. Like the guy is recreating kills from other famous serial killers. And it feels like, especially in like our current time frame, true crime is like huge. It's like a giant category in podcasts, in TV shows, in all sorts of media. And I didn't really realize that in the 90s, there was this sort of appetite for historical serial killers. And like, so, you know, we've heard about Berkowitz and Son of Sam and Bundy and John Wayne Gacy and all these like serial killers in real life. But honestly, I didn't know that it was something that was in the cultural zeitgeist in the 90s, the way it was in this movie, which was interesting. And so, like, I don't know, like, what did you think about the way that these murders were staged to, like, lead up to, I guess, her eventual killing? And maybe this is going to be your complaints about the, like, process of this serial killer, Luke. But what do we think about this guy having an encyclopedic knowledge of different methods of killing people based on famous serial killers?
So the execution was shoddy, to put it that way. But I did actually really liked the kind of plot point that this serial killer, Peter, was killing people and leaving the scene of the crime exactly how victims of previous serial killers were found, right? And like, you know, down to the very minute detail. And that gave that, until the reveal, it gave the sense that, wow, the serial killer knows his shit and is like very meticulous and, you know, is someone that is dangerous and should be taken very seriously. So that was cool. And then the fact that it was following the same order as the lecture that she gave, I thought that was neat. And then I also, like, obviously the acting aside and the very flawed character not matching up with the way he was doing stuff with Peter at the end. But I did like how, you know, when she is tied up and she's trying to escape, she ruins his perfect serial killer thing by trying to hang herself, right?
Yeah, dying and that's early, how,
Yeah, and that's how Sigourney Weaver is able to, you know, fight back and get out of the noose. And I really like those kinds of details. And I thought that was like a really interesting way of telling the story and for like interesting characterization. And it was just like the execution to get to those parts was not great. But I did like those plot points.
Yeah, I thought that was like a clever use of, you know, again, she's a psychologist, so she knows, she's profiled him to a T where he's recreating these murder scenes exactly the way it was, down to the like the no dumping sign where he dumps the body and whatever, the note in the phone booth, blah blah blah, all that stuff. And so she knows that if she wrecks the tableau, he like psychologically won't be able to handle that, and it'll maybe buy some time for her to escape or for Holly Hunter to get back up and take him out. And yeah, I think it was a clever way to handle that. But
well, and one way to think about it too is that this might be one of the first ever internet movies. This, because 1995 is a pretty big year for the development of the internet with the release of Windows 95,
baby.
And although it looks like they were still kind of using Windows 3.1 in some of this, but I can't really remember what the visual of 95 looked anyway. But like, I think one of the things, the broader social point about maybe serial killers in the 90s is that there was a technology explosion in information technology. In like that year specifically, 95, where, you know, for the first time ever, like this is internet 1.0, right? This is, I think it was commercially launched in 1991, and then actually kind of, I think email came out in like 95 as well. So
yep.
You know, you have this brand new world revolutionary technology that's accessible to most people now. And this guy is obviously using the internet to do what he does. And it would have been a little bit, as unbelievable as it is now, it would have been a lot more unbelievable if this movie was set in like the 80s or something, you know, without yes. this like communication tool available to him. And I thought that was a pretty interesting, because like, I mean, obviously the internet is saturated in our lives now, and this would have been maybe, I bet you that would have been a bigger talking point when this movie came out. It was like, wow, this like brand new technology is really in this film, and it's cutting edge and revolutionary. Yeah. And I think that's, and also, so now like we get it a little bit, like your first ever kind of chat room / message boards about this stuff. So if you do have an interest in true crime or serial killers, for the first time you have a kind of digital community around it. So I think that's like an unspoken part of all of this too, which is that's aged better than anything else in this movie, I'd say, in terms of what the world is like today. You know, it's only gotten more that way.
Yeah, I think this is a great segue into the sort of technology of it all. And you're right, like the clicky keyboards, the giant monitors, like she's got three screens before people were doing LCD monitors, and they're all giant, mm-hmm. big, boxy things. But I just looked it up. Windows 95 was launched on August 24th, 1995 for like general public. So if this movie takes place in 95, it is maybe early summer, early spring. So it's before the launch of it because, right. yeah, it didn't look like she was still using a Windows 95 interface. But oh my gosh, just like seeing the scrolling message boards where she's like in agoraphobia message board. She's got another screen that's just dedicated to playing chess with some guy named Checkmate. C-Z-E-C-H mate. I was like, oh yeah, the internet is great. You can go anywhere and talk to anyone in the world. And it just strikes that tone that I remember very clearly because I had family members that were like really on the cutting edge of technology. And when they talked about the internet in the 90s, it was like, it's gonna change anything. You can talk to anyone around the world instantaneously. It's gonna be so great. And so it just feels like it really did a good job of capturing this, like, what is the internet? But also it's so ridiculous to what it is now. It's like, oh, you can just send a program that can be run once, and then it also has an animated icon that runs away into your computer. Okay. Sure.
Yeah.
You know, it'll play a movie only one time, and if you don't back it up to a tape, then it's gone. It's just like, oh, this liminal space between the analog and the digital era was exemplified in the 90s. This is so good. Mm. And as my Discord name is 1995 Screensaver Appreciation, because there was a lot of good. I was like, oh yeah, I remember the fish. I remember the one that was just like balls of color appearing on the screen.
Yeah.
I was waiting to see one that was just all those little twisty pipes. They're like corkscrewing around.
Yeah, flying Windows logos.
Flying Windows logos, yeah. Yeah. What do you got to say about the tech, Alex?
I don't know. I wasn't alive back then.
You were alive in 1995.
Yeah, but I didn't touch a computer until at least 98.
As sure. we know, Alex has told us, it doesn't really count until they're like 5 or 6, right? Human beings aren't really worth
yeah.
saying are there yeah. until they're about 5 or 6.
You know, you were using a computer when you were 2, I'm sure.
That's true. No, definitely not. Not like today when like little kids can use tablets, little babies and stuff.
Yeah. But... No, I remember Windows. I actually do remember Windows 95. And then we upgraded to 98. And we stuck on 98 until XP. So we didn't do 2000. We didn't do me. We were a 98 fam. Yeah. And then, you know, obviously I remember, like, none of this was in the movie. I'm just, for me, I remember the dial-up tone. I remember, you know, don't use the phone. And then I remember, who the fuck picked up the phone? You know? Stuff like that. Yeah. Yeah. And then, yeah.
How exciting it was to download a song that only took 15 minutes instead of 4 hours.
Yeah. Yep.
I remember floppy disks. That was a big one.
Yeah,
I remember floppy disks. I actually did use it for school once. I had to bring a Word document from home to school.
Oh, yeah. So you had to bring it on a disk because they didn't have thumb drives yet. I remember doing that. Like a lot of like early PowerPoint presentations being saved on a floppy disk.
And then I remember having fun with the floppy disk by like flicking open the metal part where the disk actually is. That's
so good. Yeah.
Hours of entertainment. That was the original fidget toy.
Yeah.
That's right. Yeah. But like, I think just looking at in this movie, the technology, it was cool to see like early Photoshop, but it just kind of like all the skills that this Peter serial killer had. Incredible. So like he knew everything. He knew, was so skilled in everything and decided to take the route of a serial killer. So what a shame.
And I think that's like, that speaks to a very particular type of fear and zeitgeist at the time in the 90s when it was like, oh, if you don't know computers, you're out of touch and people are going to run laps around you.
You're going to get serial killed.
Yeah, you're going to get serial killed faster than you can even think about it. Like, forget it. And I think like it's just this like this fear around technology and like the people who could figure it out had an edge against the people who were stuck in the past and behind. And it just like the acting where they're trying to get her to like play the video again. It was just like, oh, yeah, this is like when you're helping your parents with tech support stuff. And they're just like, I don't understand how these like how to set this stuff up. But it just like in that moment, the personification of Peter was the like, ooh, if you don't understand how the internet works and how computers work, then bad actors and bad agents will be able to get one up on you and it's over for you, like Luddites basically, which is just so funny. He knew everything.
But really the true horror is old cops who need to go fix car alarms rather than do their job. I will say that was the one part of the movie where I actually was like, fuck off movie. Like, he just, it just was so, so lazy. It was just so lazy, such lazy writing to get that guy out of there. You're guarding someone who's getting hunted and you are tricked by a car alarm and no one else can deal with it.
Right.
You don't think maybe this is a diversion? It was, yeah. That one was too hard for me.
And it was like, it wasn't even parked like it wasn't even in the parking lot. Like, they had a shot out the window and it's just like in the middle of the like quad,
yeah,
going off. And so here's my question for you. And I know the answer for myself as well. If a car alarm is going off, do you go outside and investigate it? Is that
absolutely not?
No, right?
No. I might check if it's my car alarm.
Sure.
Right. As soon as I know it's not my car alarm, it's not my problem.
It's not your business. Yeah.
Yeah. But I mean, that also speaks to, you know, if I were to see someone stealing a car and the car alarm was going off, would I intervene? I don't know if I would.
I don't think I would.
Yeah. Seems dangerous. You know, there's serial killers out there.
I wouldn't intervene, but I would make sure that I got, like, I intentionally worked at remembering what the person looked like.
The license plate.
And was wearing.
You know, you can take a video now, right?
Yeah. That's true. Well, it depends how much time you have.
Yeah.
But it's like,
fair enough.
So it's like, this is a PSA for witnessing a crime. It's actually really easy to forget the color of someone's
Absolutely.
Shirt or their hair color or their height or all that kind of stuff. So I think there's like, it's recommended that if you do witness a crime to like actually consciously think about that kind of stuff while it's happening. Even if mm-hmm. you like lose some details of the whole, like to remember things actually correctly is pretty crucial.
Well, Not only is it easy to forget, you know, colors and features and stuff, but your brain, in the process of remembering under high stress situations, can transpose qualities onto different things.
Totally.
So it's like, oh, this person had black hair and was wearing a brown shirt. Your brain, when it's looking at it, could be like, black shirt and brown hair. Like, yep. it just codes that information in a split second. And
there's a great line in Memento about that where Lenny's talking about it. It's like, memory can change the color of a car. It can change the angle of a room. It's just, it's not even that good, you know? So he's like talking about why he's actually less at a disadvantage than anybody else in his life is, which is, of course, mm-hmm. a good setup for later in the film.
Yeah, memory is like a huge liability and it's not reliable in a lot of cases, and especially in, you know, high stress situations.
Yeah. I love Memento. I think I might pick it for next week.
Because we're a movie podcast.
Because we're a movie podcast.
What phobia though does it fall under?
Yeah, what phobia?
Remember phobia.
Ah, mementophobia.
Yeah, amnesia phobia.
Getting back to that point about the laziness of the cop being drawn out by this car alarm. It's like, buddy, you are hired for this purpose of protecting this person, and you don't leave your post. Just don't do it to get the cop out of there. So silly. And then
I did like how when Ruben showed up after, he's like, I'll deal with you later. Like, of course, this cop was an idiot, right? Like, you have to acknowledge that. And I like that the character did.
Yeah, true.
They did take a second to be like, what the fuck were you doing, sir? Like, you should have stayed at your post. Let's talk about Ruben since you segued onto there.
Sure.
And Alex, you said the Chekhov's Chinatown case.
Yeah.
Did you want to expand on that at all?
I mean, like, leading up in this entire movie, Holly Hunter's X was who was played by
Will Patton's character
Nico.
Nico, that's his name, right? So Nico, every time they're like, oh, Nico's working on the Chinatown case, or it's like, Nico, like, what are you working on? Oh, they're still working on the Chinatown case.
I'm over in Chinatown.
It's the Chinatown case, and I get it, it's San Francisco, they got a massive Chinatown, so mm-hmm. they probably need a dedicated Chinatown case taskmaster. Or task force leader. I don't know. Whatever.
Or maybe
called.
It's a precinct located in Chinatown or whatever. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And then they're just hinting on this Chinatown case. And then in the middle of the movie, there's just a bunch of Chinese people in the police station, which I assume is the Chinatown case. And then, you know, I did enjoy that because they were speaking Cantonese and I could understand it all. And it was very fascinating.
Okay.
Just like, it wasn't very fascinating. It was just like typical, like don't nobody move or, you know, stuff like that.
Yeah, okay, yeah. Okay.
And it just so happens that Chekhov's Chinatown case becomes a thing in the building, manifested. And Ruben gets murdered by, I'm assuming, a Chinese gangster that was a key suspect in the Chinatown case. I don't know. I don't know. There were just a bunch of Chinese people in the police station at that time. And yeah, that's how he dies. And I mean, it was kind of important because, you know, at the very start of the movie, there's also Chekhov's brachial nerve, right?
Yep, brachial nerve shot. Yeah.
Yeah. So Holly Hunter shoots Chinese gangster's biracial nerve and he drops the gun, and she's like, yeah, I got him, and I didn't even have to murder him. And then it turns out he wasn't incapacitated, so he picks up the gun again and kills Ruben, and she's like, oh no, my entire theory of not killing someone and shooting them in the shoulder, that's like, oh, yeah, that's something I have to deal with.
Now I definitely have to kill the next guy I shoot at.
Yeah, like, which is what happens. So yeah, it was just, it could have been any case. It could have been any case.
Yeah.
But I appreciated that it was the Chinatown case, and it was, yeah, a bunch of Chinese people in the police station.
That was the movie. That was the part of the movie where it took a break from being a not horror movie to be a melodrama.
Yes. Yeah. That part really like pulled down the second act, and like as a way for like Holly Hunter's arc to, I guess, teach her that she should be shooting suspects more fatally, which is, I don't know if that's a lesson we need to be imparting to the law enforcement. Like, it's,
that's a very also, 1995.
Why
point,
is there, you know, a loaded gun in the room with criminal suspects? Why?
Luke, it was in a locked desk.
No, it was Nico's desk.
Yeah,
right?
But it wasn't locked, was it? He just opened it.
Yeah, it wasn't locked. He just like took it out.
No.
It was supposed to be locked. That's why Nico had to hand in his badge.
So here's what happened. Nico sits down at the case. He gets his like keys out and puts it in the lock. And then the big brawl happens with all the like people in the precinct. All the Chinese people start fighting and everyone's screaming. And they're like, what are they saying? And he's like, I don't know. I speak Mandarin. I don't speak Cantonese. So he jumps in to like intervene, but he leaves his keys in the lock of the desk drawer.
That is unacceptably negligent as a police officer. So, that is fire
and then
worthy as a police officer.
Yeah, well, he does get fired. But then, like, the guy who's handcuffed to the chair, like, sees it, scooches over, not noticed in the big sort of melee, and is able to pull the gun out.
What?
And then,
but it's also just such a stupid idea on his part. Because even if he kills,
yeah,
what does he think's going to... He's in a building full of cops who all have guns. You think they're all just going to shoot his brachial nerve?
We made this exact same point when we watched Malignant. Mm. And look at what happened to the cops.
And Malignant
same thing
their
when
asses.
We watched Jeepers Creepers. Look what happened to the cops.
Yeah, but...
you know, yeah, but... if I learned anything about horror movies, and this one is no exception, if you are a single person in a police station with a weapon, you can take them all out.
You got a chance.
Obviously not, given what happened to that guy.
Well, but he didn't die. He got arrested and he got taken away because he only got shot in the brachial nerve. But yeah, like that whole sort of her, I don't know, because there's that scene very early on where we're introduced to Dermot Mulroney and Holly Hunter's character where they're doing the like obstacle course or copsicle course. I'm going to call it that. Yeah, the copsicle course.
Nice.
And he just like ends the obstacle course by being like, San Francisco PD, freeze. Blah, 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 blah. And she's like, you shouldn't have done that. And he's like, I think I survived, though. And it's like, what is the message we're saying? It's like, okay for like people just to shoot indiscriminately?
Yes, no. That is the lesson we're saying.
No.
And it was okay back then.
It's not okay.
Allegedly, it was okay back then.
It's not okay now. But it's just like, because I thought, here's what I thought. Here's what the 2023 version of me thought was. She shoots the brachial nerve. It doesn't put him down. So she's like, oh, maybe it doesn't neutralize the threat all the way. So I thought that the movie was going to end where Peter had Sigourney Weaver's character in the same situation. She does the brachial nerve shot again and then shoots him in the head or something. But it wasn't even like a chance for her to learn how to like do the brachial, like do her special disarming shot a little bit better, which I was like, oh, that would have been such a, I don't know.
Isn't that what she did, though?
Lesson.
She did shoot Peter there, and then she hesitated for a second, and then he went back up, and then she double tapped, right?
No, because like Sigourney Weaver like gets away, and she like distracts him, and he turns around, and then she shoots him in the chest a bunch of times, and then in the head. She does like the Dermot Mulroney action of just like shooting right away.
She learned her lesson of how to deal with suspects properly, right?
No.
Also, that final scene would have been so easy for Sigourney Weaver to like motion with her eyes or her head to the cop lying on the ground as the, like, because Peter doesn't attack Holly Hunter for like a minute in that, and she spends at least three times she looks directly at Sigourney Weaver's face, and all it would have taken is one, and it's just like, what the fuck.
Well, there is like a shot where she does look around, she looks down into the corner, and I guess the case is like in the first time it happened to her, the killer was hiding in the stall next to her. So I'm like, oh, she's signaling that he's in the stall next to her. But then she completely ignores that scene by like going to the start of the line of stalls and like kicking the doors in one by one. When it's like she signaled to her left, your right, and you go to your left. It's like, no, your other left, Holly Hunter, yeah. Other left. Like, what are you doing?
Not great. Yeah.
We needed extra tension where she kicked in all the doors of the bathroom. But also, no one else at that university. There's no security office. Like, it's just an abandoned university. Whatever.
Well, Peter's
late at night.
Peter's
and
executions.
Spring break.
Peter. Everything Peter did in this movie necessitated breathtaking ineptitude from every authority figure.
Yeah. True. And like,
and he got it.
You know,
he got it.
He got it. It necessitated that, but it also necessitated a disinterested wife or partner who was just there to, I guess, be cannon fodder because she didn't even... I thought she was there. Again, this is me 2023 brain. We see that he has a wife. She's got a dog. They don't have a physical relationship at all. She's like, go have fun on your computers, honey, whatever. And he's like, okay, talk to you later, friend, or whatever. Mm-hmm. And like he does, you know, she says, I love you.
Let me just go down to my dungeon.
Yeah, she says, I love you. And he's like, yeah, me too. And then he leaves, which is like, okay, this guy's a psychopath. But then I thought what was going to happen was that they were going to get this tip of the gold VW bug, and it would be a false lead where they go like, oh, well, it's registered to like such and such, and it's registered to his wife. But no, they're just like, it's registered to Peter, serial murderer. Here he is. Here's his address. It's like, oh, damn it, movie.
He blows up his own house in San Francisco.
Yeah.
He blows up his San Francisco
house. The property
house.
Value alone makes this a horror movie.
Right?
What are you doing? There we go. Now we're all, it's back. We're back. Flag unplanted. We're a horror movie podcast again.
Nailed it.
You nailed it. But anyway, I will say, like, while nothing was scary, it was a surprise that Ruben died. I thought he wasn't going to die for sure. I was like, oh, damn, that, like, took me off guard. So I guess props to that, but maybe not props, because if you just throw a ball at somebody from, like, their blind spot and it hits them, you can't be like, oh, I guess that surprised you. It's like, no, I didn't see it coming. How could I? You were behind me. Should we talk about Harry Connick Jr.'s character of the, like, serial killer in prison? What did we think of his sort of Jigsaw-esque puppet master portrayal?
I mean, once again, it's, like, incredibly inept, but is somehow the villain of this story and has been in control from the very start. Okay.
He's got a following. He's got a cult. He's got apparently access to early Zoom or early Skype or something. That was kind of, again, old technology. I was like, how is she watching him? She has no webcam on any of her computers, but that's fine. But yeah, what did you think, Luke, about Daryl Lee Cullum?
He was fine. He was
fine.
I don't know. He was unbelievable. Like, he was not... He was unbelievable, but he wasn't any more unbelievable than anything else that happened in the movie. So I just... It fit. I guess it fit.
So the idea is that, like, he was this serial killer. He tried to kill Sigourney Weaver's character at the start of the film. And then in the year since, he's amassed some sort of, like, weird groupie following of disciples of people who want to take down this big profiler.
Well,
like,
and
other
also
would-be serial killers.
Why are these people following this cult leader who actually failed at the killing? Because Peter has a line in the bathroom. He's like, too bad Daryl Lee just forgot there was a second cop. It's like, well, that seems relevant.
Well, yeah, and they like...
Or maybe it's more of a, like, maybe they less look up to him, but more see it as a challenge. Like, I could do it, but better.
I could do it better. Give me your information. I mean, maybe, but he also had this weird sort of, you know, he invoked the name of Jesus and stuff and like, oh, God spared her. And if you're one of my disciples, then maybe God will grant you the ability to do what I could not, or blah, 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 or whatever. You know, he compares himself to Jesus, where we're just like, okay, so this guy is just like a psycho. Like, he's just a psychopath. Or
no, I don't think so. I think he's just a cult leader.
It's just a cult leader. Yeah, okay. But also, yeah, he's sending out messages and letters and information and writing a book that apparently he can get published and sell while he's in prison. And it's just like, I don't think going to prison is like a time for you to work on your side hustle. And you're going to write a book about the like attempted murder of this person from your point of view. And the prison is just going to be like, yeah, we're fine with this. It's actually okay. You can publish it. That's cool. We'll help you out. You want to send some letters?
I don't want to read. It's not unbelievable, though, right? Like, don't people write letters to inmates all the time?
That's still but they're screened.
That's a First Amendment
issue. Are they screened?
Issue.
They're all screened?
I guess so.
are prison letters screened? Here. Are Maybe, prison I... letters screened?
In the U.S. Might be different in Canada.
They have to be. But I also think that, like, that decision wouldn't necessarily United be up to the prison. States. That decision would be up to, like, a publishing company.
I guess so. But, I mean, you're right. It's also, like, it's not like he's there on, like, a break and entry charge. It's like, this guy is a homicidal maniac. So maybe we...
I don't know. I mean, like, they interviewed...
Look at his stuff a bit more.
They did interviews of Jeffrey Dahmer in prison to get his side of
yeah,
things or talk to him. I mean, like, again, back to the true crime, like, there is a fascination with this shit, right? And the real god of America is that they'll print anything that'll make money. You know, like, if a publishing company thought, hey, there's, like, there's a market for this book, it will definitely happen. It's really hard in the United States to censor, like, a work of... nonfiction if anybody wants
unless you live in Florida, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, even that is going to be challengeable, let's say.
Yes, they're not scared of trying.
Apparently letters are screened, so no, you're right.
So it just seems like maybe if this guy is sending out letters that's like, hey, maybe you'll have a chance to kill this person better than this guy did because he lost the way, maybe as the prison communications officer you go like, this one's for the shredder. Like, unless he, maybe his like network is so robust that he can smuggle it out, but who knows? Mm-hmm. Who knows? Anything else?
Yeah, it was an interesting reveal that he was the puppet master from the very start, but then also the reasoning behind it is quite lame, I would
quite
say.
Quite lame.
Yeah, like I said earlier, plot points are neat and cool. Execution wasn't quite there.
Yeah, just a little bit too, I hate, I don't know. Unsophisticated is not a good enough word.
A little
word.
Too it's Hallmark, a, if you know
it's
what
not
I
a sophisticated mean, right? enough word for me, but this movie was kind of unsophisticated in its plot, yeah.
It was a little too pat. Just a little too pat.
Sure. A little too pat. Okay, then. Final thoughts. Final thoughts, Alex Wan, on Copycat.
No real final thoughts. Yeah, I'll save it for the review.
Well, we did it. We did the review. Luke, anything last that you didn't talk about that you want to mention?
No, I mean, this movie was totally fine.
Yeah, it kept my attention, I will say, for being a two-hour movie. The part with the Chinatown thing with, like, his death, that did drag, but it was engaging enough to keep going. I will say we didn't talk much more about Andy, her assistant, who, again, we thought was going to be revealed as the killer, but I just love the vibe in the 90s of like, okay, we have a gay character, we'll do everything but like mention the fact that he's gay, but they'll have a conversation about how they both think this guy is cute. He will be seen with like a very obvious partner leaving, but they will not hold hands, they won't touch, they won't kiss or anything, because it's 1995 and gay people are only allowed to sort of be talked about right now.
And Will and Grace hasn't come on the air yet, so we can't.
Will and Grace
it.
Hasn't come on the air yet. We can't. Sorry, there's nothing for it. We gotta wait for Will and Grace to come out, they all said. Yeah. But so I was just like, oh, okay, that's a little queer baity, but also for the time of 1995, I bet that was progressive as hell, where they're like, did you say they had a gay in the movie?
Well, do you think they, so maybe they were being progressive, or maybe do you think they added in the gay character? Because they're like, yeah, Ted Bundy is going to be one of the serial killers.
No, Jeffrey Dahmer.
Jeffrey Dahmer, not Ted Bundy. Jeffrey Dahmer, that's right. They're all the same. They all maybe. Kill people.
I feel like, yeah, they could have. They're like, well, Dahmer killed gay men, so we need to have a gay man in here. And it's San Francisco, which is like where gay people came from. I know that's, I'm joking. For legal reasons, this is a joke. But...
Oh, for tens of thousands of years, San Francisco has been this genesis.
The hub of the gay community. Yep.
Hub of the gays.
Again, funny. For legal reasons, this was a joke.
This is not financial advice.
This is not financial advice. But yeah, I was just like, okay, sorry, Andy, you lost your head. That sucks. And let's talk about the slim pickings of scariest part of this movie. So have you got one, Alex Wan?
I do. So my scariest part of the movie was when Sigourney Weaver's character, I think I've said Sigourney Weaver every single time. What's her name? Dr. Helen Hudson.
Helen Hudson.
When Helen Hudson first gets that email and you just see like, it's like weird, it's creepy. And then when the face of the girl that Peter is going to murder becomes like a skeleton skull thing.
Yeah.
It was creepy. It was a little unsettling. So that would be my scariest part of the movie. Apart from all the, you know, gruesome murdering. But yeah, that would be it.
That's a fair one. Yeah, that was a little bit unsettling, where it's just like she dies and then there's like fire behind her and like worms are coming out of her stomach and stuff. It's like, oh, okay, this guy is not normal. But boy, oh boy, he knew his way around 1995's Photoshop and animation studio. Like, he just, I wonder how long that took him to put together, because I've edited stuff. It takes a long time.
Rotate 35 degrees.
Merge onto this face. My scariest part of the movie was just the blackout marker they put on Harry Connick Jr.'s teeth to make him look like he had scraggly little teeth. And it's just like they put Sharpie on his incisors, or whatever these ones are, these front ones. And just like, oh, it looks so dumb, because it looked basically permanent ink. And it's just like, oh, he's really, really like leaning into this grimy, grotty, gross looking dude, because Harry Connick Jr. is a handsome guy, especially 90s Harry Connick Jr. He's singer, songwriter, dancer. He was in Will and Grace, so maybe he told people that they could have gay people in TV now.
Don't worry. Yeah, it's coming. The show's coming.
But his tooth like prosthetics was just like, oh, this is so bad. And maybe in the 90s, the resolution wasn't so sharp. You could get away with it, but definitely didn't buy it in 2023. Luke Mason. Scariest part of
there
this.
Was no, there was
maybe
no,
a horror movie.
There's no part of this movie that approaches scary. Even a little bit.
Okay.
But the most annoying part was the car alarm. That was the most emotional I got in the film. I'll put it that way.
Sure. Very fair. Very, very fair. All right, then. Let's rate it. Alex Wan, what are we going to rate it out of?
We're going to rate it out of, what's this cheeseburger doing in my pocket?
Very good.
You can't eat ethnic food like sushi. Here's a burger. Jesus.
Executive decision.
Oh, the
nice. Yeah. No, I, like, this is not a horror movie. We are now a movie podcast. I'm on board with you for that, Luke. The agoraphobia was a minor part of this movie.
Woo! Gesundheit.
I need to edit that out. Or keep it in. I don't know. Wherever you want. Maybe there's some weirdo sicko out there that likes listening to people sneeze. You know who you are.
Right in. Tell us.
Yeah, but I would say I was like pretty entertained for most of this movie, even though it wasn't spectacular. It wasn't terrible, but it wasn't spectacular. And like I said, Holly Hunter and Bangs for 2 hours, like, sign me up for any of those movies.
She was very cute. Yeah.
And I will watch every single one of them. So yeah, I'm going to give it 2.75. What is this cheeseburger doing in my pocket out of 5?
Sounds good. Luke, what's your rating?
Yeah, we didn't talk about her a ton, but yeah, Holly Hunter kind of carried this for me. Just her accent is on point. I don't know. She's like the perfect combo of sassy and sweet, I guess. And so
she's got that southern charm.
Totally. Yeah. This movie is nostalgic for me, and it's funny unintentionally, I think, but not in a totally bad way. But it's not very good in its execution of a lot of like what we're supposed to imbibe as what's happening. So yeah, I feel the same as Alex. I think 2.75 is a totally adequate amount of cheeseburgers out of 5 to pull out of my pocket.
Pocket cheeseburgers. I agree. Considering I started this movie thinking it was a mishmash of two different completely movies, when in fact it was this third one, it took me a little while to be like, oh, they're not going to do a weird single white female stalker plot in this movie. Okay. I got to get on board of a different kind of film. Yeah, it's very 90s. The portrayal of agoraphobia, I think, was heightened for dramatic effect. And also, I don't know, I guess she's agoraphobic, but she had a reason to be. It wasn't delusional. And I would have liked, I think, more weird for me to say, but I think I would have liked a little bit more gaslighting of the people around her, where they're like, there's nothing going on. What are you talking about? And like, she has to convince them that she's not just delusional. But I think that's a movie that gets made in a different decade of cinema. So I think I will be in line with you for surprise pocket cheeseburgers. 2.75 as well for me. We're all awesome. Matched Great. Up. All right. Only one thing left to do, and that's cheer something. So Alex Wan, kick us off with the something to cheer.
Okay, yeah, it's been a beautiful weekend. So yesterday I got together with some old work people, some people you'll know. So, and we went and sat on the patio at Loco Lou's 2.0, and they've upgraded their balcony.
Oh, cool.
Patio. It's got new flooring. It's got new benches. They've gotten rid of the tacky lights. Umbrella, so it was much wider open. Open wider?
Nice.
Wider open.
Much open more spaces. Wide open. Yeah.
Yeah, much more wide open. But it past tense, so wider opener.
It was gaping. It was more. It was gaping.
It was more.
Yeah.
It was the patio goat.
The gape goat. The gape goat.
Thank you, Luke. Yes, it was the gape goat. So it was nice to, you know, sit in the sun, have some drinks, catch up. And yeah.
Nice.
Well, hello, hopefully that doesn't make me a friends. Scapegoat.
I hope it does.
Scapegoat throat.
Okay.
You're the best, Billy. Thanks for giving us all this comedy gold.
I guess so. Like, I don't know how to feel about that. Luke, what are you cheering?
Short and sweet, simple. As of last week, the outdoor ultimate frisbee season has started. So we're playing outdoors again.
Nice.
And it's just gorgeous. So I love it.
Beautiful. Yeah. Yeah. Getting outside, getting some running in. That's what I'm doing. My cheer is something very silly, but we have been looking for sort of stuff to just put on in the background when we're cooking or cleaning up and not wanting to commit to a big long show. And so Kelly and I started watching Bluey, which is a show for children. I admit that's a show for children. But boy, oh boy, did I underestimated the quality of writing on this show about Australian healers, families, learning life lessons. If you have small children in your life, you should be watching Bluey.
Is it?
You know, I'm an adult who likes Bluey.
Is it related to Calvin's favorite book, Hamster Huey and the Gooey Kablooey?
Hamster Huey and the Gooey Kablooey. No, but I do think that Maple Syrup was a writer on the show.
Okay.
No, like it's a very charming, sweet show about this Australian shepherd family of dogs, and they learn life lessons through the like lens of their two young kids, Bluey and Bingo. And it's very sweet and very charming, and there's jokes for parents in there as well. And
B-L-U-E-Y.
Every episode is 10 minutes.
B-L-U-E-Y and Bluey was his name-o.
Yes, Bluey was her name-o.
Oh, her name-o.
Plus, also, I have a soft spot for Australia because I lived there about a decade ago, and I love Australia. It's so cool. So it's like kind of nostalgic as well. Anyway, this cartoon dog show, great show.
Nice.
You should watch it.
Is there going to be a sequel called Bluey's Clues?
No, but there was a meme I saw that said every generation a blue dog must help the children of the world, and it has four pictures: Huckleberry Hound, Snoop Dogg in a blue t-shirt, Blue's Clues, and then Bluey.
That's pretty good.
Yeah. Anyway, that'll wrap us up. We'll talk about the movie for next week. So, Luke, I'm on tenterhooks about what movie you're going to pick for us to watch in Phobia Month. We got three phobias left. I'll let you take what pick you want. Maybe we're just watching a comedy movie.
So I'm going to tell you, I do have a movie picked, and I'm going to tell you the title. Okay. But for a little spice, a little suspense, I'm not going to tell you which phobia it's for. You're going to have to figure it out while watching it.
I think I have a guess, but I want to hear you say it.
Are we watching Spider-Man 2?
No.
The Amazing Spider-Man 2.
The title of the film won't give it away. So next week, we are going to be watching another found footage film called The Taking of Deborah Logan.
Oh, shit. Okay.
You know about this movie, Billy?
I've heard rumors about this movie, but I've heard it's very scary. So, Taking of Deborah Logan.
Yeah, I decided, no, we are going to be a fucking horror movie podcast again if I have anything to say about it. So, we're going to watch The Taking of Deborah Logan.
The Taking of Deborah Logan. If you know the phobia, you know the phobia. And
that's right.
I do. So, ooh.
Have you seen it?
Exciting. I haven't seen it, but it's been because, like, I spend a lot of time on, like, horror movie social media. It comes up a lot, and people talk about it, and there's a very infamous screenshot from the movie, I think, that speaks to the phobia part of this one. So,
we'll see.
Good pick.
Is Liam Neeson in this one?
I don't think so.
I don't think
so. Oh, no, that's Taken. Okay, my bad.
That's just Taken. Yeah. You're thinking of Taken 2.
I have a very particular set of camera angle shots.
Those can change. Well, yeah, we'll say goodbye. But you know what? Because we haven't really done I've been putting the recording at the end of it, at the end of the episode. Luke, do you want to share anything that you've been doing with Full Spectrum Cinema lately?
I mean, we went down to bi-weekly. So now we're only every 2 weeks because...
Okay.
Life's busy for the both of us. I have been taking a kind of hiatus from podcasting and in general, other than this one, but I've been playing a lot of guitar. So if you ever, if you want to hear guitar, just walk around my house. That's what
I'll say. Okay. You all know where I'll put the address in the show notes so people can just show up at Luke's house.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Alex, anything going on with One Song a Day lately that you've been wanting to share? Or?
No, I post a song every day. It hasn't changed.
It's good. And you got some good songs.
Speaking about bi-weekly, Luke, I heard a funny joke the other day.
Okay.
So this guy said, I'm biracial. Mm. And he goes, yeah, I'm... So I'll say it for my sake. I'll change the joke a little bit. So I can be like, I am biracial.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm actually half Chinese. Both halves.
It's good.
Okay. All right. All right. That's going to do it for another week at Nothing to Fear. Tune in next week when we talk about the taking of Deborah Logan. I'll say goodbye. Check out the links for our socials and everything. Follow us. Say hello on there. Luke, say goodbye if you'd like.
Goodbye if I like.
Thank you very much. Alex, you may also say goodbye if you wish.
Goodbye if I wish.
Excellent. And remember, folks, they're just movies.
They are just movies. Just movies.
Especially since it's not a horror movie. It's not a horror movie podcast anymore. Woo. All right. Bye, everyone.